Now, the top of the hour on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn presents the Green News Report.
National interest will be served only if this project does not significantly exacerbate the problem of carbon pollution.
The EPA just gave Obama a reason to reject the Keystone XL pipeline. New rule, feds must take future sea level rise into account. Extreme weather whiplash from record snow in Boston to record drought in San Francisco. Plus,
it's one reason why I don't think they can avoid this question in a way that they have in previous campaigns.
Majority of Americans, including Republicans, now want action on global warming.
All of that action and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
When you get the AFL-CIO against you, when you get the Teamsters against you because you're taking extreme positions on pipelines that actually make the environment safer.
Right.
That's denying science.
Wait a minute. Is that Joe Scarborough?
Yep.
Did he just say opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline was extreme?
Yep.
Did he say it's better for the environment?
Yeah.
And then he said those who oppose it are denying science.
That's right.
And that was on MSNBC.
Yeah.
The supposedly liberal news network.
Right.
Right. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, 3 hours of Republican Joe Scarborough every morning on MSNBC means that's the liberal network. So you've got your work cut out for you today.
Yes, yes, I do.
Before you begin, however, I want to welcome aboard Green News Report's newest affiliate partner, FYI Nation Network. Glad to have you guys on board. Glad to be in the FYI Nation. Check them out at FYINation.com.
Welcome to the club, guys.
Okay, Desi, with all of that out of the way, what do you have for us today?
Big news in the Keystone XL pipeline fight. This was President Obama back in June 2013.
National interest will be served only if this project does not significantly exacerbate the problem of carbon pollution.
The Environmental Protection Agency just gave Obama that reason to reject the controversial project, saying on Tuesday that the pipeline from Canada, quote, represents a significant increase in greenhouse gas emissions.
Why is it suddenly now significant?
The EPA says that the current crash in oil prices means that building the proposed pipeline will be vital for Canadian tar sands developers, and that will increase production, and that will increase emissions more than what would otherwise occur if the pipeline weren't built.
So the prices are low, therefore Canada has to pump out more tar sands, therefore it's going to significantly exacerbate the problem of global warming.
That's right. Rail transport for the developers becomes uneconomical at these low oil prices.
So now they really need this pipeline more than ever, and yet it can cause more damage than ever, according to the EPA.
That's right.
Don't tell Joe Scarborough.
It's not the end of the process yet. The president still has to make his final determination, but this is a significant development. Meanwhile, while the Republican majority in Congress was distracted by legislation to force construction of the pipeline,
legislation that will be vetoed.
That's right. President Obama quietly made a major change to federal policy last week. He issued an executive order saying from now on, all federally funded projects must include future sea level rise in planning and construction.
What does that mean?
That's to ensure that tax dollars aren't wasted on repeatedly repairing projects that are only going to flood again and again with climate change raising sea levels.
So they must take that into account before they begin a new project.
Before they can even approve a project, if they want to have any federal funding.
There goes Obama being a tyrant again.
An emerging consensus on climate change. A new New York Times poll finds that an overwhelming majority of the American public, and this is including half of Republicans, accept climate science and support government action to curb global warming. Two-thirds in the poll say they're less likely to support any candidate that denies global warming. That is set to be a major issue in the 2016 campaign.
So this is a real problem for Republican presidential candidates. Half of their party wants action. But the bulk of the base, who they have to win over to even get the nomination, has been conned into believing climate change isn't even happening.
Yeah, it's going to be quite a minefield for them.
Nice way to put it.
Finally, wild weather whiplash. Boston was hit over the weekend with the second major storm in a week, setting the record for the snowiest seven-day period in the city's history, getting a whole season's worth of snow in just 10 days. But it's the opposite case for the city of San Francisco that recorded no rain for the month of January for the first time ever in 165 years. Nothing. Zero. That's it.
It was funny. I was seeing right-wingers on Twitter pointing to the record snow in Boston to say, that proves there's no global warming. Good luck with folks like that in the Republican presidential primary.
Yeah.
For much more on all of the stories we covered today and the ones we couldn't get to, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please remember to make a donation to help the Green News Report stay on your public airwaves. Don't count on Joe Scarborough to educate the public. Find us and follow us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Please come to Boston for the springtime.
This has been the Green News Report on the Top of the Hour on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
This is Terrence McNally, and this week I share with you one of my favorite previously recorded interviews with Amy Bach about her book Ordinary Injustice, How America Holds Court. Doris Kearns Goodwin calls it a magnificent work, a crusading call for reform in the tradition of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, or Ralph Nader's Unsafe at Any Speed. This interview originally aired in November 2009.
Lawyers sleep through trials. False confessions and mistaken eyewitness identifications convict the innocent. The rich walk, the poor go to prison. Today's guest, attorney Amy Bach, calls the sad state of affairs ordinary injustice, and that's the name of her first book. Bach spent 8 years investigating the chronic lapses in courts across America. And ordinary injustice goes beyond one particular injustice, one specific court, or one aspect of the legal system. She rejects the easy explanations of bad apples and meager funding. Instead, Bach shows how legal professionals routinely choose to collaborate rather than face off as adversaries. Her investigation, from small-town Georgia to upstate New York, from Chicago to Mississippi, reveals a culture of complicity among prosecutors, defenders, and judges that rewards shoddiness and sacrifices defendants and victims to keep the court calendar moving. Stick around for the next hour as we go beyond television's popular procedurals, the Law and Orders and the CSIs, and inside the real court system in America, where too often the poor are guilty until proven innocent, and before that happens, Hades is likely to freeze over. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Amy Bach, a member of the New York Bar, has written on law for The Nation, The American Lawyer, and New York Magazine. And she's taught legal studies at the University of Rochester. As I said, Ordinary Injustice, How America Holds Court is her first book. Welcome, Amy Bach, to Free Forum.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Okay. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So briefly tell us about your personal path to the work that you're doing today.
Well, I decided to write the book in 2001.
Further back than that. How does one settle on, in other words, I know that, for instance, you were a journalist and then decided to go to law school. So how did you choose the law as the path you wanted to write about? And you get where I'm going?
Yeah.
Take us back a little further so they get a feeling for you.
My first job out of undergrad was working for a law magazine called The American Lawyer. And that magazine back then was run by a man named Steve Brill.
Mm-hmm.
Extremely high standards for his reporters. We used to talk to, hundreds of people just to write a single article and to make sure that we got the story right, doing the mental gymnastics to really make sure that all the facts were lined up perfectly, and that not only that everything in the article was correct, but that our general take on something was correct. So I became really interested in the law, but I think that that experience at the American Lawyer was crucial because we were often writing about, you know, the best lawyers in the country in terms of making money. You know, people who, you know, made millions of dollars a year, and here we were, these, you know, 20-somethingers trying to write about what they were doing wrong in big litigation. So that was really my first job. And went, and after about 2 years, I decided that I wanted to become a lawyer. And the reason was is because I felt like, you know, you would have a lot more capability to make a difference if you had this credit card, which is a law degree.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ended up doing a special journalism program at Yale Law School, where they gave you the first year for free with the hope that you would go off and be a journalist again, but with the legal knowledge. So I did that. Then I went back to being a journalist for a year, and I said, you know what, I think I'm more of a lawyer than I am a journalist. And I decided to ultimately finish, and I finished at Stanford. And then at the end of Stanford, I was going to go become a lawyer, and I clerked for a judge, which is something that people do in after law school. And the jurisdiction of the judge, which is was the federal appellate level, which is, you know, the level right before the Supreme Court, and the jurisdiction was Florida, Alabama, and Georgia. And I actually clerked for a woman named Rosemary Barquette, who is one of the great heroes. People often don't know about who the appellate judges are, but she's the judge who so often is the dissent in this very conservative circuit. And so, for example, Troy Davis, you know, his case.
Sure.
Up, right. Well, he, you know, just for listeners who don't know, this is a man who the Supreme Court recently said that, you know, innocence is a constitutional issue and sent it back for further hearings because I think it's six of the witnesses who said that he did this crime, he killed the police officer, now have recanted. Anyway, she was the dissent in that the Supreme Court made the majority. So she's constantly the person saying, no, 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 you're not seeing things the right way. How could you all be so blind to this? Look at what's going on. She's anyway, so that was another thing that shaped my view of the law. So I worked for her. And then when I was working in this circuit, I got an idea to write a story about voting rights. And I wrote this story for The Nation magazine, and it was widely picked up. And I was a consultant for ABC News on its story on the topic. And The Nation said, wow, if you could do this again, we'll give you a year to write about civil rights. So I spent a year going around to different courts in America writing about different topics. And that's when I got the idea to write this book.
Very good. Okay. Let me just tell people, I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Amy Bach. She's the author of Ordinary Injustice, How America Holds Court, in which he asks and answers the question of how and why justice in the U.S. fails on a daily basis. And thank you for that. Now, let me take it the next one, which is that they what you were about to say, which is how did this book happen and why? I mean, you've given us some of the background, but what did you set out to do and what do you hope to accomplish?
Well, the court that really made me realize that I wanted to write a book was in a county called Greene County, Georgia. And it's this beautiful area where President Bush actually vacationed three times during his presidency because his largest fundraiser lives there. And I walked up the stairs to this court in a really early morning, and I saw this lawyer there named Robert Cerency, and he was standing in the center of a swarm of people who were waving papers at him, demanding to talk to him, and the place was just, you know, filled with people. You could barely get a seat. And what would happen was the judge was inside, and she would call a name, and the person would go inside, and after speaking for about 2 minutes with Robert, who would give them what the offer was from the prosecutor, they were expected to plead guilty before the judge. But the problem was that nobody had really talked to them about him, talk to their lawyer about the real individual circumstances of what had happened to them. And so in court, it became incredibly obvious that something was awfully wrong. One woman started crying, and she said, I didn't know I was going to jail. And, you know, if you're pleading guilty, you should understand that you're going to jail and what you're going to jail for. And, you know, that is the, you know, de minimis. That's the minimum.
Right, right. That's kind of basic.
You know, but he hadn't done really the legwork that was needed to wrap his head around what these people wanted or needed or what their circumstances were. So afterwards, I went and I watched him in this way plead 48 people guilty in one day, which is quite a lot. And afterwards, I went and I asked the judge and the prosecutor and the defense attorney, you know, how do you think it went? And they all said the same thing, fine. And what fascinated me was that these were smart, hardworking people who went to court every day and did their jobs, but at the same time, they had lost sight of what it is that they were supposed to be doing and never really realized that anything was missing. So what I decided to write a book on was ordinary injustice. And by this I mean the idea that the people who work in the system could stop checking each other, not realizing anything was missing, and what they did had extraordinary consequences for regular people. But the part that was ordinary was the blindness to stop realizing that they had fallen so far afield and that injustice had become ordinary.
Right.
Anyway, so then I decided to write this book on this, you know, I wanted to write something on how regular people were treated. And I honestly thought at that point it was just going to be about indigent defense. I thought it was going to be about the sorry state of this. And what I found was, as I started sitting in courtrooms, once I got a book contract, I started sitting in courtrooms, and what I found was that it wasn't just defendants. It was half the book is now about victims, and half of it is about defendants, because when one part of the adversarial system collapses, it affects everyone, you know, because what happens is, now let me take a step back here. What I'm talking about is a collapse of the adversarial system.
Right, right. And yes, by the way, I appreciate that. So let me tell people we're talking about that what goes on in courtrooms in America and why they fail so regularly. And so, yes, give us some background. So now we're moving into the thesis here. We know why you've taken it on. And one of the things I want to say, Amy Bach, is that in answering that question, you told us a story, and for anyone who is thinking about this issue and thinks dry legal stuff, the book Ordinary Injustice is woven through with stories, and it's stories that make the point. Let's get to the background of the system as it exists on paper, as it exists, let's say, in civics classrooms and so on, and then what's actually happened.
Great, and thank you so much for making that point that it is a bunch of stories, because what happens often is, you know, I tell people I worked on this book for 8 years, and they say, oh my God, it must be so legal, it must be so dense, but it's a fun read. It's about people like you and me who want to do a good job and then end up, for some reason, you know, it's not for some reason, they end up giving up their own power and giving it to somebody else and ends up in this systemic mess.
Right, and the other thing is that it is only 258 pages.
Exactly.
So, you know, and I will go back to, there's one quote that's attributed to Mark Twain, another that's attributed to Kant. The one attributed to Kant is that he worked 5 years on his doctoral thesis, and it was only 10 pages long. And when they asked him why, he said, if I'd had 10 years, it would be 5 pages long. So I understand that to take 8 years to come up with a 250-page book is much tougher than to take 3 to come up with a 500-page page book.
Yeah. Thank you. Finally, someone understands.
So, the context.
Okay. So here's the way that the system is supposed to work. It's supposed to be the American adversarial system is a prosecutor against a defense attorney with a neutral judge above. And the prosecutor is what we see on Law and Order. You know, this is someone who works day and night in his office, and he's thinking about whether or not he's got the right person, and he's going, you know, and meeting with witnesses constantly, doing the legwork, conferring with people in his office or her office, you know, about really wrapping your head around a case to make sure you've got it right. And the defense attorney is the same thing, but except that he or she is a real counselor to the person that he or she represents. the type of person, a real friend, putting his hand on the defendant's shoulder and saying, "Don't worry, we'll do the best that we can, under the circumstances, whether you're guilty or not, we'll give you a good defense." And then there's the judge, who sort of sits above them. It's almost like you can make a triangle among the three points. Okay, so the judge is above and protecting people's rights, making hard calls to make sure that fairness is accorded to all the procedures. Now, like when I teach my course at the University of Rochester, I ask the students, well, what shape does this take? And they said, oh, it's an equilateral triangle. That's the shape that justice is supposed to take. But what happens when it goes wrong? My students say that they line up. Everybody lines up almost like in an arrow, where the prosecutor, defense attorney, and the judge are all standing next to each other, and they're pointing towards something, but it's not justice.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you, what is it? And I think that answer would come from you and then from them. From what you've seen, what is it that it lines up toward?
Oh, that's a great question. Okay, from what I've seen, I think it's lining up towards self-protection and keeping their jobs. So that often means giving something that they shouldn't be giving up. For example, in the case of that I just told you about with Robert Cerency, he was not providing adequate defense to these people. But in his mind's eye, he was. In his head, he was. But what he was also trying to do was to keep the calendar moving.
Right. In other words, one of the things, let me lay in some background here, is that one of the realities that we face is that in many, many court systems around the country, the folks who do public defending or defend indigents are extremely overloaded. And so
this guy had twice the number of cases that the ABA recommends.
Exactly.
And there's a lot of pressure on the judge to get through the cases.
The judge, the prosecutor, and the lawyer in some sense.
Different pressures they need to get through these cases.
But it's all to keep it moving. We're overwhelmed. Let's keep it moving. And I know one of the things, whether you were going to get to it or not, is that at the end of one of these days you watched of Cerency in Greene County, Georgia, do maybe 48 guilty pleas, and you questioned him about how it had gone, and he said they all got their day in court.
Right, exactly. Nobody could say that they didn't get their day in court. And he said, look, we've successfully done a 10-page calendar in one day as if speed equals success. And so it's almost like it's very similar to if you live in a family, and your family doesn't tell you, what is expected of certain behavior. Nobody says, but you have a sense, and you do what your family wants. And this courtroom becomes like a family where they see each other day in and day out, and they know, Robert Cerency knows that if he gives really excellent advocacy, if he, pushes where he's not expected to push, that he'll lose his job. So, because he can't be too good. Mm-hmm.
And one other thing
that'll screw up the whole day.
One other thing that people probably don't know, and this is, I mean, I can't speak for everything, but I know some numbers I found in the book, that he's under, and maybe now's, I'll set it up and then you can tell people,
okay,
that there are like three systems for dealing with public defense. And the one that he's under is this contract system where someone bids that they will handle all the public defending in that county or that jurisdiction for a certain amount of money. And I'm reminded of in the I Love Capitalism, or what's it, Capitalism, A Love Story, Michael Moore's new film, where he points out that pilots make much less than you'd ever imagine, that you're putting your life when you get on a regional aircraft in the hands of someone who might be on food stamps. And the reason he chooses it, because, it's so crucial a role and yet they're so underpaid. The amount of money that some of these folks are taking in those contracts is unbelievably small.
That is right. That is right. That they aren't paid well. But the thing is, everybody's not paid well. I mean, the judges aren't paid that much. The, prosecutors aren't paid that much. And one of the things as I go around the country talking about this, is that people always say, so, but what you're talking about is resources, right? The problem is that people aren't paid enough. Yes, everyone needs more money, but that's not the only reason why this is happening. And I think I'm going to sort of tell the end of chapter one here, even though I hope it doesn't ruin the book for people, which is that at the end of this chapter, and this is why it was so great that it took me 8 years, because I went back and I saw Robert Cerenzi 6 years later, and he had actually had to leave that job, in part because I wrote an article about him, and in part because he was called before a commission where he testified, and he left his job in Greene County, and he couldn't find a job for a long time. And then by a comedy of errors, he ends up getting a job in the best public defender's office in the entire state. And there, according to everyone, this guy is a fantastic lawyer. And he goes to the jail, and he visits people more than most people. He uses an investigator more than most lawyers, and he's winning his trials. And when I asked him, you know, do you feel that you've seen the light, that you're now doing the kind of job? And he said, no, I'm just being the kind of lawyer that I always thought in my mind I was. And so the idea is that we have to create these better contexts for people, because it's, you know, there is a sense of agency, and I'm not saying there aren't bad apples out there. There are these freaky people who, you know, will take bribes and those sort of things, and these aren't the people that I'm talking about.
Right. That is not ordinary injustice. That's extraordinary injustice.
Right. Exactly. Like, there are these judges in Pennsylvania, and they took bribes, and you know, to get and they put kids in prison. They took kickbacks. No. That is extraordinary, and that is not what this book is about. Well-intentioned attorneys who end up chronically underserving the people they're supposed to be protecting.
And the point you make with Cerenzi, and in the movie script, that would be his redemption, right?
Is that
the team you're part of affects how you play, and so that's why you're saying it's not just funds. Even those places that may not have enough money, if there somehow has grown in there a different ethic, a different culture, that people, except for the very worst and the very best, will play the way the team plays.
Right, exactly. Houston County, which is the best county that was run by this woman who created this incredible public defender's office there, she fought tooth and nail to get every little bit of resources, but yet they were extremely underfunded. Almost near Greene County in some sense. And the interesting part is that the person who replaced Robert Cerenzi in Greene County was supposed to be this fabulous lawyer who, for the first time in his life, is getting handfuls of complaints against him to the local bar association, saying he's ineffective and that he's forgetting to do their appeals. And he says, you know, he basically said I'm gonna have to quit because I can't do this job. And it's not just and he had better resources, but what it was, there was a community of people in that court that made change unlikely.
Yeah. Let me tell people, I'm speaking with Amy Bock. She's the author of Ordinary Injustice, How America Holds Court, in which she asks and answers the question, how and why does justice in the United States fail on a daily basis? And as she points out, it's not just with the indigent. It's the system ends up affecting everyone. And you can learn more about Amy's work and these issues at ordinaryinjustice.com. Okay, so let me see. I want to make sure that we didn't leave too many threads hanging.
Okay.
In terms of the context is it's supposed to be adversarial, but it's become a dysfunctional family in which everyone is overloaded, overwhelmed, underfunded, and so they end up teaming up to just push things, grind meat through the system. And the people who get hurt, as you point out, are not just the defendants, but others as well. And justice, of course, is deeply wounded. Let me ask you this question, and we've got a lot more we'll cover, but okay. I loved this quote. When I began this book, I took a wager that ordinary citizens, most of whom will never face a criminal prosecution, could be roused to engage with what transpires in the nation's courtrooms. In other words, to my question, why did you write this book? How did this book happen? That's a piece of it, right? Is that you actually don't just want to write a book, you want to start a movement.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. You're asking all the right questions. I usually, you know, have to, you know, drum this in myself. And let me tell you, the hardest part about selling this book is this is a book about inertia. You know, this is a book about what happens when nothing moves.
Yeah. Business as usual.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And what the book argues is that, you know, courts are the most unexamined public institution in America. And Americans have to take back their courts. And the problem is that right now, if you live in a county in America, you probably know where the good schools are. It's in your county, or is it in the county over, or is it the county south of you or north of you? And you know what the taxes are in that county and what that investment yields in terms of test scores, teacher-student ratios, college acceptance rates. Or, I go to the library here where I live in upstate New York, and I can get a pamphlet that tells me what the water supply is. So I have a general idea of how good, what my water is and whether I need to filter, that sort of thing. There is nothing like that that tells us what is going wrong with the criminal justice system. And the reason is because Americans have left it alone for so long that things can degrade. And at times, issues come before the American public and they say, oh my gosh, how could that have happened? How could there be, 240 people freed on the basis of DNA evidence? And aren't these cases amazing that we see on the front pages? And how could this have happened? Well, you want to know why it happens. It happens because we've left the ordinary alone for so long.
Right. And so let me go again, and we'll revisit this question maybe again, once again at the very end. So your wager is that ordinary citizens will care when it's pointed out to them. And I'm skeptical, because that inertia is not just in the courtroom. That inertia is also in the society. The way that I have often looked at the war on drugs and certain environmental policies is that they are on a majority of people's, maybe in some cases a vast majority of people's, to-do list or priority list, but they never make it above 3 or 4, right? So what
right.
what gets dealt with is those things that are number 1 or 2, and that keeps changing. But these things that we know, we know the war on drugs doesn't work. We know certain things like that. My fear is that people will say, "You're right, Amy," but. I'm trying to make a living. I'm trying to get gay marriage passed. I'm trying to get global warming stopped, etc. Your thoughts on that?
Two thoughts. One is a statistic, which is Jeremy Travis, who's the dean of the John Jay Criminal College in New York City, wrote in an article that 47 million people have criminal records. Now, that's approximately 25% of the nation's adults. Can you imagine that a public institution that affects 1/4 of the nation's adults goes completely unmonitored and is unaccountable? We don't do it for anything else. Our schools, our water supply, our hospitals. Doctors get all sorts of scorecards.
Right.
And we shouldn't do it for our courts. And it doesn't just hit poor people. And, I had one professor when I was giving a talk at a law school say to me, maybe this is just the way that we, society, is happy with dealing with the lower class. Maybe this is just our way of, and that's why there isn't a response. First of all, I don't buy it, and second of all, it doesn't just hit the lower class. It's the middle class and it's the upper class, and maybe people who have means have a better way of dealing with things. But if they had a way to express the fact that it had hit them, I guarantee that there would be the political will out there because. People don't know that why things go so wrong. They think that it's just a one-off situation. They don't realize that they're part of a pattern. Now that was the first part of the answer, but the second part of the answer is that Americans just don't want to leave it this way.
Uh-huh.
And we know this because of the response to Innocence, I think.
Oh, to the Innocence Project.
Yeah, to the Innocence Project.
Right,
the,
and for people,
people
who don't know,
care about the courts.
That's Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, am I right, or is it Richard Neufeld?
Yes, yeah. But they're also Innocence Project.
Right. But they have a wonderful book that I'm going to tell people that one, you can Google Innocence Project, but the book Actual Innocence.
Actual Innocence, yeah.
And there's a documentary. I forget what the name of the documentary is, but if you look it up, you can find it. Because I've had the documentary folks on. I've had Barry and Peter on more than once. To me, this is an amazing issue. But what you're saying is their book is about what the lead sort of Actual Innocence is that through DNA testing, people who were convicted of capital crimes are exonerated. People who spend years in prison for rape or murder are exonerated. Now, what their book actually shows, and I think this is something akin to your book, two things that are akin. One is they also do it through stories, as you do. But they also show that the things that get the publicity are the DNA exonerations. But the errors that led to those false convictions apply in every kind of case, and DNA only matters in very few. And so if you don't have DNA on your side and you fell victim to improper eyewitness identification, bad science, I heard an amazing thing on the radio within the last 2 or 3 months that someone had finally done a meta study of forensics and found out that other than DNA, almost every form of forensic science that we use that gets so much airtime on television do not have scientific evidence that proves they're valid. That's the ballistics test, the gun matching. Am I correct?
I don't know for sure.
Oh well, check that one out when we get off the phone, because it blew my mind. And that, again, it's like what you're saying. The fact that something like that could exist, I think, supports what you're saying, is that this is a system that isn't monitored, it isn't measured, people do not know what's going on. This is Free Forum. Today, we're talking about what goes on in America's courtrooms. Amy Bach, a journalist and a lawyer, has written a book called Ordinary Injustice, How America Holds Court. And
I want to add one thing to what we were just talking about, whether that the public doesn't care about
very good
injustice. And one of the things, I've been talking to a lot of law students, and they are so fired up. They care so deeply because they haven't been in the system yet. And I think that one of the things is, if we really want to change things, we have to tap into their energy. There's a group of law students right now at the University of Michigan working on the first non-DNA innocence project at a law school.
Excellent.
It's only been around for 10 months. Started in January. And they're on their fourth person they're freed in 10 months, only at four, which is incredible. So if you think about, you know, Northwestern, their undergrad program has worked on these cases, and they've freed 11 in about a decade. And they've done four in 10 months. And the reason is because there's so much low-hanging fruit.
Sure. A system that makes this many mistakes. Yes.
Exactly. So they're going in and reversing the ordinary injustice. They're going in and finding the cases where the defense lawyer just, you know, didn't bother to interview the witnesses. And that's the kind of regular and mentions it to the prosecutor. You forgot to interview these people, and the prosecutor, you know, said, oh, and then nobody ever does it. You know, and that's the kind of thing, that kind of agreement to be sort of lazy or flaccid.
Well, no, what you speak to right there, Amy, I definitely give you that. In other words, I was saying that if it took the community to be the driver, I'm you know, sadly skeptical. But you're right, there is a constituency, and it is a constituency of young people who've chosen to go to law school, who've just spent enormous money going to law school, who've just devoted their life to something and made a life choice, and as you say, have yet to be infected by the mediocrity and the inertia and the ordinary injustice. So I agree. I mean, I can imagine that is an army of people.
Yeah, well, that's the hope.
Okay. Let me go, as I had mentioned this to you prior to when we went on the air, that when it fits, I like to use a simple format I call It's Broke, Let's Fix It. And for the next little less than a half hour, for about the next 20 minutes, let's do it, which is three big questions with something that's broken. And we're saying the American court system is broken. How is it broken? What's the evidence? We've talked about it some, but if you can just lay it out, you know, numbers and that sort of thing. How did it get broken? What are the causes? What's the history? How did we get here? And then how do we fix it? What are the solutions, which, of course, is your conclusion chapter. So how is it broken? What's the evidence that our court system doesn't work?
The evidence that our court system doesn't work, in my book, is that I went around and I looked at courts around the country, and it was very, very easy to find places where the lawyers had stopped checking each other, and where the adversarial system had collapsed. And I really want to make this point here that it's not just defendants, it's also victims. There was a county that I went to in Quitman County, Mississippi, where my phone was ringing off the hook, and I couldn't figure out what was going wrong. And I went to this woman. Her name is Miss Wiggs. She's the clerk of the courtroom. She's a helmet of white hair and bright blue eyes. And I said to Miss Wiggs, I can't figure this out. What is going on here? These horrible stories, but they're not lining up. And she said, well, you want to know what's going on? Look right here. And she points to a list above her desk. And what's on this list are names of defendants who have been charged with crimes in a lower court, and a judge has bound these cases over to grand jury for the prosecutor to introduce them to the grand jury. And the prosecutor, when it comes time for grand jury, only, you know, brings 8 cases, but yet on this list there are 50 cases that should have been brought. And I said, well, why weren't they brought? And she said, I have no idea. People call me, they're very upset, and I just tell them I don't know, and I send the list to the prosecutor, and they never seem to come to court. So what I did was I used this list as a roadmap to find out what was going wrong in Quitman County. And what I found was that entire categories of crime had disappeared. And by this, I mean, you know, I meet a woman who has been beaten up terribly by her boyfriend with a tire iron underneath a bridge while her daughter and niece were watching from inside a locked car. And she has these contusions all over her back. She's in the hospital for 2 days, and her case is never prosecuted. So I try and say, well, what went wrong? What went wrong in this case? Why wasn't it prosecuted? And it turned out that there hadn't been a domestic violence case prosecuted in 21 years. But the problem was, let me repeat that, in 21 years.
In this particular county, under this.
Yes,
and that,
right.
Now, 21 years sounds like more than one DA. Am I correct?
He actually had been the DA for all that time.
Oh, wow.
There's been
okay.
Other assistant DAs, but he had been the DA.
Okay.
And the reason why it hadn't been brought is because they didn't work in terms of, like, he felt like he couldn't win in these cases. And he paid a lot of attention to cases where he knew that there was a lot of bang for the buck. If there was a big murder, he would go full hog, do huge investigation. But if there was drug cases, you know, drug possession cases, he would do those. But for cases where he really had to go back to the crime scene, you know, find the hair weave that had fallen out and the shoe and the, you know, go back and get the weapon and da-da-da, and then maybe there was it was probably going to go nowhere in the end anyway, you know, because, you know, victims of domestic violence might flip-flop,
right.
That kind of thing. He just would wrap it up and hope that and disappear. And that's because in the adversarial system in America, prosecutors have too much discretion to bring a case. They don't have to coordinate with the police. There's no check on either of them. And in this county, there would be long-standing patterns, but no one could see them. And the point that I often make when I talk to people is I say, we just don't know what the patterns are in America. So that is the problem with the justice system, okay, that it's allowed to collapse and you can't see what the problem is and we can't change what we can't see.
Right. So, again, now that defines the problem. The evidence that it's broken is, one, that, but it's also just to sum it up, it's that the poor – get terribly inadequate public defense. Victims of certain kinds of crimes do not get if you can represented by the prosecution. And what else would be these things that you just look and you go, this is evidence that it's broken.
That a judge can grab power in the absence of checks when the defense attorneys become incompetent and no one's checking to see if they fall down on the job, and prosecutors have too much discretion to bring a case, and no one's checking that, a judge also can grab power and disregard people's rights, and no one says anything because everybody has sort of fallen down on the job. There's a judge in my book,
right,
in upstate New York, who gives outrageous bails, like $20,000 to a homeless man for riding his bike on the sidewalk without a bell, and then doesn't give a lawyer. And, of course, the guy, you know, comes back after spending 8 days in jail and pleads guilty. And you may think, oh, well, that's a homeless person, and they just want him off the street. But it hit, you know, nurses and, students who went to college. And
right. You tell – and, again, Amy Bach tells these stories of – the student who ended up dropping out of high school because she missed so much time
exactly.
under one of these situations, or, as you say, the nurse and mother of several who spends time in jail because of the way this system is working. So that's so, and also in the construction of the book, what she has is the first chapter focuses on defendants, the second chapter on a judge, the third chapter on a prosecutor. So you begin to see how each of these is taking their role in this dance to injustice.
Right. And so in terms of how is the system broken, there are uniquely American failures in the criminal justice system, which is the prosecutors have too much discretion to bring a case. The prosecutors don't have to coordinate with police. Defense attorneys can be incompetent, and no one's checking if they fall down on the job, and the judge can grab power.
Very good.
All of these things, add up and can lead to chronic ad infinitum ordinary injustice.
Okay, let me ask one other thing before I get to the how did it get broken, which is we also have this system with way too many people in prison. I mean, we dwarf the rest of the world in incarceration and so on. I've always, the first thing I always reach for is the war on drugs as an explanation for that. But it sounds like the failures you're talking about, while some victims' cases never get prosecuted, the other side of it is that it is this system that ends up putting too many people in prison?
Right. I mean, clearly the laws are what they are, and they need to be changed as well. That's definitely a part of it, but this is the mill that makes it happen.
Right. Right.
So this is a part of, the overcrowded prisons. But this is where it all begins.
Okay. So, and let me just let me ask one other question, because I don't want to miss it by getting to the end without asking it. Okay. And that mm-hmm. is that. Let me see. I want to make. Okay. How does the current financial crisis affect these problems or the likelihood of solutions? Let me just say, it looks to me like the poor are more desperate, which means there could be, an uptick in crime. Millions more are becoming poor, that people who have had jobs are losing them. And the governments responsible for the court system are starved for funds. Actually, a local station board member who works within the court system wrote me when I told him I was going to deal with this. The most recent California budget politics have resulted in a current year $90 million budget reduction for our local L.A. trial court that will escalate further next year and move the court beyond furloughs to 20% layoffs, extensive courtroom closures that will severely impact society and the provision of justice, particularly for the most disadvantaged. So,
right.
This is likely to make things worse, yes?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
First of all, all across the nation right now, there are public defenders' offices that are losing staff, and they can't keep up with the crime rates during times of greater opportunity when they could. Places where, more crimes often happen during times when there's less opportunity.
Of course.
Right. And in Georgia recently, there was a 10% cut across the board in public defender's office. And many offices have been stretched to the limit and are further understaffed due to budget limitations. In Miami, the public defender's office filed suit a few years ago saying it couldn't continue to take on so many cases. But it lost that suit in 2008. And the Kentucky Department of Public Advocacy filed a suit also, saying that it couldn't handle its caseload with the money it was getting. And they negotiated with the governor, and it still resulted in a cut. Really, our current economic reality, with its potential rise in crime, creates even greater need for timely reform.
And, of course, we have governments cutting budgets and looking for places to cut and so on. So it may get worse before it gets better. I'm Terry McNally speaking with Amy Bach about her book, Ordinary Injustice, How America Holds Court, in which we're really looking, as I have seen seldom books do, really looking at what actually happens in the U.S. court system. So the second question, how did it get broken? What are the causes? What's the history? Has it always been so in America?
This is not going to be a very satisfying answer, But we have no idea what the history is, and we have no idea now what's going on, you know, because courts are the most unmeasured institution in America.
It's going to keep coming back to that, isn't it? I mean, really, our solutions piece is the one that's going to be really strong, because it's clear that the start is to know where we are.
Exactly. You know, we just don't have any idea how much money is being spent, you know, on an engine defense on a case-per-case basis. You know, no one's keeping track of what kinds of cases go to court, what kinds of cases don't go to court. So I'd like to say, oh, yes, there's been a terrible demise since the 1970s when there was a huge increase of people in the criminal justice system and, you know, it used to be better. But, you know, the cases back then were terrible. You know, we always have examples before the U.S. Supreme Court of case law where you look at the facts and you think, you know, how could this have happened? And you know, I want to say one note on that, which is, this is a slight tangent, but you know, I recently wrote a piece for Slate magazine about the Joe Sullivan case, which is the case of the 13-year-old boy, and the issue is whether or not he should get life without the possibility of parole.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, everybody has been talking about, you know, does the United States want to, he's one of two people of that age to be given right now, to, you know, to be given such a harsh sentence, which means that he never comes up for parole.
That's right. In other words, the point there, let me just tell people this. Obviously, should we make a distinction between adults at whatever, you know, 21 or whatever, versus young people, 13, about their ability to change, their ability to reconstitute themselves as they grow, and that's what's really a question here.
Right, and so I was going to write something on this for this magazine, and so I asked to get the original trial transcript. And usually, when I've written about trials before, you know, boxes and boxes come, and I have to get a whole separate table, and then I have to, you know, label them, and all that came was like this 3/4 inch pamphlet. Okay, and I read this trial transcript. The lawyer decided not to make an opening statement, his lawyer, okay? The lawyer then didn't question these two other co-defendants who got very good deals. You know, they're in jail for months and years, whereas this guy goes to prison for the rest of his life without even a chance of parole. They never tried to show an incentive that they were trying to perhaps save their own skin. And then Joe Sullivan, the 13-year-old, always has said has proclaimed his own innocence to this day. And then it was virtually no closing statement. And at the very end of this trial, the judge said something which is incredible. He said, you know, I'm going to make sure when I sentence you that you are a very old man when you get out of prison.
Forgetting that the sentence was life without parole.
Right. And nobody stood up to say, wait, I just want to make sure there's been a change in the law recently. We just want to make sure that you understand that life without parole now means you never, ever get out at 13-year-old. And that, this is the kind of thing where we're in the why does it happen? It happens because it's much easier for the people who work in the system. And this is the point of the book, for people to punt. You know, because the crime that this poor boy was charged with was so horrendous. Okay, I mean if he did this crime, you know, but do we know who this boy was in the first place? Do we know whether he really was the monster who raped an elderly woman? We never really found that out. And so the point of this book, of my book, is to say that we need to start going back to the ordinary, because we're looking at all of these heady issues of, you know, oh, incarceration, we're incarcerating too many people, we're giving 13-year-olds life of the possibility of parole. Well, all these things started in some little courtroom in some county in America, and we can't begin to fix the end product if we don't start with the very basics of the ordinary. And so in terms of, you know, why these things happen, it happens because in courts across America, people aren't getting checked. Do we know how prevalent it is? No. But if you look at the big cases which come to the U.S. Supreme Court, it's just too easy to see the problems.
Mm-hmm. In other words, what you're saying is these glaring errors that elicit outrage,
yes,
are not the exception. They are the natural product of a system like this.
Exactly.
Okay. And let me tell people, by the way, if you email me at T.E. McNally, one word, T.E. McNally@mac.com, that I'll put you on a list and you'll get a weekly email that'll tell you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about. This week, that email talked about Amy's book and so on, and that article from Slate about the Sullivan case was what I put in there as background. So each week it's like, here's what we're going to do, and here's some background on it. The third question, Amy Bach, is how do we fix it?
Well, the book calls for monitoring and measurement so that we can see the kind of errors that are being made. As I mentioned, the leading scholars all say the same thing, that courts are the most unexamined public institution in America. No one's keeping track of what kinds of cases do and don't go to court, how many cases are being pled, what kinds of crimes are not being prosecuted, and for what reasons. So, you know, here's some examples. How many cases get put aside? For what reasons? Was it a domestic violence case? Was it drugs? Was it sexual assault? How many people plead guilty without attorneys? What is the time that people spend in jail before pleading guilty? How high were the bails? What were the costs of holding people in jail? Not only to the county, but in terms of collateral consequences. There's a whole section in my book about people who lose their homes and their jobs and they go on welfare because of the run-in with the criminal justice system.
And what you're pointing out there is that those costs then go to both sides. In other words, the cost to that person who lost their home is one thing, but the person who wasn't on welfare and now is a cost to the public.
Exactly. So we need to start measuring these sort of things. There are people that are doing this work. There's a woman in North Carolina for Indigent Defense Services there who has been working on a pilot project for several years now. People at the Kennedy School of Government do this sort of work internationally, and yet Americans leave their courts completely alone.
By the way, you just led me to my next question, which was, we're talking about the U.S. system. We're talking about it being the most unexamined system in America of one that matters. What is the situation in other countries?
Well, you know, it's so different in other places, and people always say to me, but don't we still have the best criminal justice system in the world? And, I mean, give me another 10 years and I'll give you the answer.
Right. That goes right along with don't we have the best health care, right? It's just so funny how it's unpatriotic to tell the truth. You get what I'm saying? It's like they just say it and everyone nods their head. Oh, yeah, we're the best. We have the best health care. We have the best court system. Wrong. Go ahead.
the thing is that people say, one of the things that I've been sort of criticized for is, the stories in the book are so horrible and the things that people have to endure on a daily basis are so extreme. Why do you even say that we should keep the adversarial system of justice? Why don't you just throw that out the window, and why don't we use the inquisitorial system and the continental system, which Europe uses, which has this and this and this? And, you know, and here's the problem. The American criminal justice system is so – the adversary system is so a part of the fabric of who we are. That's like saying – to say throw out the system, it's like saying, well, 50% of marriages fail. Let's throw out marriage. Well, no, we can't do that because it's so much of who we are, mm-hmm. This myth of, you know, law and order and – Kill a Mockingbird and all of that. You know, that it's just not going to – we can't. So we have to work with what we have. Clearly there are places where things do work better in some ways. And let me say that I think that the American criminal justice system is beautifully designed. The idea that there are two equal sides that can hash out their versions of the truth and that
– with a neutral arbiter, yes, that picture that you painted at the top in its ideal, in its design – is beautiful. Let me tell you, if I give you 30 seconds right now, maybe 45, what should listeners do besides picking up Ordinary Injustice, How America Holds Court, or going to ordinaryinjustice.com?
Yeah, go to www.ordinaryinjustice.com. If you have a story of injustice, there's a place for you to tell me your story on the website. And next, you should write me, give me your name, and I'm going to be working on a pilot project to start to mobilize folks to work on these issues, and we're not sure where it's going to be yet, but it's going to be working in conjunction with a law school and law students, and give me your name, give me your email, and we'll involve you in the project.
Now, there's also a list of other sites that where people can learn, that Harvard site and so on and so on. That's that's on the ordinaryinjustice.com
exactly.
site?
There's a Learn More section.
Okay. So that's what you do, listeners. If this matters to you, whether you've been touched by it or not, and I bet a lot of people out there have, Go to ordinaryinjustice.com and let's start a movement that changes things. So again, the book is Ordinary Injustice, the website ordinaryinjustice.com. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime by linking to our podcast. You can also sign up to have it delivered to you weekly, and you can do that at either iTunes or at my own site, terrencemcnally.net. So either iTunes or terrencemcnally.net, you can sign up to have podcasts delivered weekly or to find all the podcasts that have been collected and archived. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and some background on it, temcnally@mac.com. Thank you to Melissa Figueroa, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi, Mark Maxwell in production, Matt Perez in traffic. To you, my listeners, I look forward to being with you again next week.